Okay, let's go ahead and get started.
So today I want to introduce discrete time convolution and explain how it works and why it's important. We have a lot of nice computer support for this particular topic, and this the techniques that we'll teach you today. This technique known as convolution is actually used in a wide range of applications, as I've talked about this semester. So I show a picture here of a conference hall, of a concert hall. If you've ever wondered in your stereos and other things how they actually implement all these sound effects processing and things, most of it is implemented with the technique that we're going to talk about today. So let's first derive the theory or derive the result of how this works, and then we'll actually show you some examples of how to do this. So what we're going to do today is to exploit two properties that we've learned about last time. One is superposition and one is time invariance. So what was the principle of time invariance?
Doesn't matter when it happens.
The output will be the same, whether you apply the input now, today, tomorrow, or the next day. And what is the principle of linearity? How do you know if a system is linear? What do you expect from a system if it's linear? What?
The output will be linear?
No. Well, yeah, but that's not quite. I mean, that's not.
X of a t is equal to a time a y of t. If you do the input output.
Y is equal to a times x. Okay. But what does that mean? What does that really mean? Is the stock market linear?
No.
If the stock market were linear, what would you expect? Not necessarily constantly going up, but what would you expect with the stock market? Okay, is your bank account, your savings account? Do you think of that as a linear system?
Yeah.
Why? What's your expectation of your bank account?
Only one input affects the output.
No?
The output is a function of the inputs?
No. Nonlinear system can be. The stock market has been a good function of your input these days, right? Now, you have a particular expectation. You have some expectations of your bank account that relate to these concepts. When you put a dollar into your bank account today, you expect what?
To get a dollar.
At least a dollar tomorrow.
You expect the output to be new.
You expect to get how much tomorrow?
At least a dollar.
A dollar.
More than a dollar, I think you expect, if you have an interest-bearing account. So there's some interest rate you can compute. Maybe you get back, you know, $1.10 or something, $1.01. What if you invest that dollar tomorrow, what do you expect? If you put that dollar into your bank account tomorrow, what do you expect will happen the next day? So you put that dollar in today, and you expect to get $1.10 tomorrow. You expect the same output. If you put that dollar in tomorrow, you expect to get $1.10, assuming they keep the interest rate fixed. So that's time invariance, right? Now, what about linearity? So you put that dollar in today, and you get $1.10 back. You'd be pretty upset if you put another dollar in today, and your bank only gave you 70 cents, right? What do you expect when you put your second dollar in today? So you get another $1.10. So your total output is $2.20. So you expect for a linear system that the input will scale with the output will scale with the input. So a dollar in gives you $1.10. $2 in gives you $2.20. $3 in would give you $3.30. And you get really upset if that wasn't the case. And in fact, with the stock market, that's not the case, right? The the function of the amount of output as a function of the input is very complicated. So one of the consequences of linearity is a principle you know as superposition. What is the principle of superposition? You use this in circuit analysis quite a lot.
You can separate each individual part and analyze them together.
Separately, right. So if a system is linear and it obeys the principle of superposition, let's say a circuit, and you have an input which consists of, let's say, a sine wave and a square wave, how would you go about analyzing the output? Or let's keep it simple. Let's say two sine waves at different frequencies.
Just analyze the sum of them.
The response would be equal to the sum of the individual response.
Absolutely, excellent. So you would compute the response to one frequency, response to the second frequency, and then add them together. Okay. That's the principle of superposition. And we will use that principle today. It's a consequence of linearity. In some textbooks, they talk about linearity and superposition. For some reason, in this textbook, they kind of lump them together. So we have a discrete time, linear time invariant system. And what we're going to show you today is how to compute the output of that system given a set of inputs. So let's begin by asking a couple questions. Are there sets of basic signals, which we'll call x sub k of n, such that we can represent any signal as a linear combination or weighted sum of these building blocks? Well, in your math classes, you've learned about Fourier series. And Fourier series, the philosophically or fundamentally, is really just a technique to represent a complex signal as a weighted sum of much simpler signals. And it does that by using sinusoids as the basis function. So there are such basic signals do exist, and the impulse function that we've talked about is actually one of those, particularly for discrete time systems. So the second question you want to ask is, the response of an LTI system to these basic signals is easy to compute and provides insight. Is there a signal that satisfies that? Well, as we will see shortly, computing the output to an impulse function is a fairly easy thing to do. And therefore, if we can decompose signals into a set of impulse functions, we can compute the output of very complicated systems by looking at each component of that system individually. So for linear time invariant systems, there are two natural choices for these building blocks. In discrete time systems, we're going to use what we call the unit pulse, delta of n, and for continuous time systems, we're going to use an impulse, delta t. These two functions will be very, very basic to the principles of linear time invariant systems, and particularly with respect to convolution, which we'll talk about today. Later we'll learn that there are many families of such functions, sinusoids, exponentials, and even data-dependent functions. Compression techniques like JPEGs and such actually derive these functions on the fly based on the data. That's one of the ways they get their compression ratios. So this notion of decomposing a signal into a weighted sum of simpler signals, this is very, very fundamental to the way a lot of signal processing systems work. So let's first talk about how we represent a discrete time signal in terms of unit pulses. So along the top there, I have a signal, x of n, which at minus 1 takes on a value, x of minus 1. At 0 takes on a value, x of 0, and so forth. And what I want to, this slide may seem simple, but it's actually, I think it's a concept that students seem to struggle with, but it's really fundamental to the way discrete time systems work. So we're going to write this signal. We'll make pointer. We're going to write this signal as a sum of these signals. So let's look first at what goes on at x of 0. If I just take a version of this signal that corresponds to what's happening at x of 0, I can write a function x of 0 times delta of n. Now, what do we know about delta of n? It's a unit pulse, which means what? In terms of its values as a function of time.
It's 1 and zero.
It's 1 and 0, right? So x of 0 times delta of n is essentially giving me this component of the signal. Okay, easy enough. What about delta of n minus 1? Remember I told you this forward-backward business is going to catch up with you. Tell me about the values of delta of n minus 1 as a function of time. The only non-zero value is when n is equal to 1. So if I take x of 1 times delta of n minus 1, I essentially get the piece of this signal that happens at x of, at n equals 1. So I can repeat that. Delta of n plus 1 will give me the value at minus 1, and delta of n minus 2 will give me the value at 2. Okay, so that's fairly easy. Therefore, what I can do is that I can actually write that signal as a sum of these delta functions, and we'll use that in a moment. So now we're going to take this discrete time, linear time invariant system, and we're going to define the unit pulse response, h of n, as the response of this system to a unit pulse function. So we're going to write this. When I apply delta of n to the system, what comes out is h of n. Oops. Sorry, something else. Keep forgetting to turn my phone off. So what is h of n? Well, for example, that's h of n. You apply an impulse, you measure what happens. That's actually a very realistic way to measure the property of a system, because soon we'll see that h of n tells us quite a lot about how this system behaves. And I think earlier we talked about a lot of different applications do this. In the concert hall application, that's one of the ways you measure the room acoustics, is you apply test signals and you measure the response, and then you can compute the frequency response of the concert hall. In geophysics applications, when they're looking for oil, they explode charges along the surface and measure the signals that come back from those charges, and that's how they measure the impulse response. So this is a fairly simple way to measure the output to a system, and it tells us quite a lot about the behavior of the system. Now, this is a discrete time, linear time invariant system, so we're going to use the principle of time invariance. And note that if I apply delta of n at essentially time zero, and I get out h of n, what happens when I apply delta of n minus k? Meaning I apply delta of n k units of time later. What should I get out if the system is a linear time invariant system?
H of n.
I should get what?
You would get the convolution time shifted twice.
I should get this h of n just time shifted by k units. And all that says is that if I hit this table now or I hit this table in a few minutes, I get the same h of n basically. Now, so we can use, well, you know, this may seem kind of obvious and trivial, but this is actually very powerful, because this says, we demonstrated on the previous slide that I can write x of n as a weighted sum of these delta functions. And therefore, the output y of n has to be a weighted sum of the outputs to these delta events, because this is just a weighted sum of delta functions. Each one of those delta functions produces an h, so the output has to be essentially a weighted sum of these h, these impulse responses. So the output of a linear time invariant system to an input is just a weighted sum of its impulse responses. So this is what we call the convolution sum. It tells us if I give you h of n and I give you x of n, you can compute y of n. And we can do that computationally this way. We will denote this as x of n convolved with h of n, and we'll use an asterisk for that. We can also compute this in MATLAB fairly easily, and in a moment I'll show you how to do a graphical interpretation of this that will hopefully give you a little more insight into the problem. So recall that linearity implies that a weighted sum of input signals will produce a similar weighted sum of output signals. If you put a sine wave in, you're going to get a sine wave out. You're not going to get some crazy signal. If you put a pulse in, you should get a pulse out. Well, sort of, but the output signal will be influenced by the impulse response of the system. Each unit pulse function, delta of n minus k, produces a corresponding time delay version of the system impulse response, and that's what we call this h of n minus k. The summation, then, is the convolution sum, and the asterisk is the symbol we use to denote that mathematically. So the output of any discrete time, linear time invariant system is a convolution of the input signal with the unit response, unit pulse response. So we're going to we'll sort of draw this in this manner. But we know mathematically what that means is that this x of n is written as a sum of these delta functions, and y of n then becomes a sum of the x of k's times h of n minus k. A discrete time, linear time invariant system is completely characterized by its unit pulse response. The unit pulse response tells you everything about the system, whether we're talking about the time domain or the frequency domain, as we'll see later in the course. And that's why it's an important characterization of the system, and that's why we often try to measure it when we want to learn something about a system, whether it be a concert hall or the surface of the earth or some such theme. And we'll talk a little bit later in the semester about some of the practical ways you can actually measure this unit pulse response. But ultimately, that is what characterizes the system. And when you're trying to design the system to meet certain specifications, like a filter to have a particular frequency response, or some kind of dynamic system to have a particular temporal behavior, all you're really doing is playing with the unit pulse response. Now this equation has a simple, relatively simple graphical interpretation. So what we'll spend the rest of the class today on is talking about showing you how we can compute this using a process called graphical convolution. So we have here a unit sample, unit pulse at time zero, and we know that unit pulse produces h of n. We know that if I shift this pulse in time, that simply shifts h of n in time. We know that if I scale that pulse, that simply scales h of n. And then finally we know that if we take the sum of all of these inputs, the output has to be the sum of all of those outputs. So that's sort of breaking this down step by step. And now we can show you the four basic steps to graphical convolution. So the first step is going to be to take this h of n and essentially produce h of minus n. We're going to use k here as the independent variable. So the first step in convolution, and I'll demonstrate this down here in a moment, is to flip the impulse response. The second step is to shift it. The third step is to multiply it by the signal values, and then the fourth step is to sum it, to sum in a result. So let's go through this sort of step by step. We have x of n, and we have an h of n as examples. So the first thing that we're going to do is to draw x of n along the, as we show. And then we're going to draw this h of n minus k, because we have to multiply these two in sum. Now, the h of n minus k is a little bit tricky. That's why we break it down into two steps. If this is h of n, what will the time reversal of that, or h of minus n, look like? It's just going to be flipped around time zero, right? So this value from minus one here, if at time two it has a value of minus one, it's going to have that value at minus two. So the first thing we need to do is to flip it. Now, the second thing we need to do is to do this h of n. That gives us h of minus k. Now we need to do the h of n minus k. As I plug in different values of n, it's a little bit hard to see, but if I plug in different values of n here, what's going to happen to h of n minus k? It's just going to time shift. And it turns out, you can sort of work through the details, but if you increase n, if n is positive, it's just going to shift it in this direction. So that's why we break this down to this flip, shift, multiply, and then sum. Let me skip this. Let me go to the next slide, which I think gives a better visualization of that. So here we have h of k. Here we have x of k. And now what I want to do, I need to form this h of minus k, which means I'm going to flip this. And I also then want to translate it to, and what I'm going to do then is essentially slide this along the axis, multiply and accumulate. Now, before I start doing that, we want to think about, well, if I'm going to flip this and call this h of minus k, and then I'm going to slide it back and forth, at some point there won't be any overlap between these two, and the output will be zero. And in this particular example, that happens at h of minus 3 minus k. So actually, start by drawing h of minus 3 minus k, which is simply h of minus k shifted back 3 time units. Okay, so that's why I start here. So you can see there's no overlap between these two signals, and therefore when I multiply them together, when I take x of k, this signal, times this signal, what's going to happen? Well, I'm going to get zero at every point. So when I sum zeros together, I get zero. So there's your first output value. For values of n minus 3 or smaller, meaning less, more negative, you'll get a zero. Now, so then I repeat the process, but now I move this, I advance this signal forward by one time unit. So here we have h of minus 2 minus k. Here we have x of k. Again, I multiply these sample by sample, and what am I going to get? Zero again, because there's still no overlap between these two. So I still get zero as an output. I repeat this once more. I shift this by another unit. So now we have h of minus 1 minus k. And now I multiply these two waveforms together, which simply means I go point by point and multiply. So the only overlap I have is between this sample and this sample, and that happens to be 1 times 1, which is equal to 1. So y of minus 1 has an output value of 1. Okay, is everyone with me? Now we have some tools. You can do this in MATLAB. We also have a Java tool that'll show you do this in an animated way. So you get a lot of reinforcement of these calculations through those tools. Here we have, again, I advance this by one. We multiply x of k times h of 0 minus k. We have overlap here and overlap here. So the product is going to be 1 times 0 plus 2 times 1, which gives me 2. So I can repeat this process h of 1 minus k, h of 2 minus k, At what point is the output going to return to zero? At some point, what's going to happen again on this side?
It's going to start hitting zeros on the x.
You're going to have no more overlap between this x of k and this h of n minus k, and it'll go back to zero. So for 1, we get a value minus 2. For 2, we get a value minus 2. For 3, we get a value of 1. For 4, we get a value of 1. What about when we have 5? At that point, we're going to have signals here, and then what? And so there'll still be some output because this is the last non-zero value of x. And then what about 6? At 6, we're going to that shifted twice from here, so we'll have a 0. We'll have a 0, and all zeros. So at 6, and n equals 6, the output will be 0. So the what time did the input begin? What time did the input become non-zero? Let's see, let's go back one more. So the input began being non-zero at n is equal to minus 1, right? And that's just essentially the point at which the overlap began. Once this has started, how long is that overlap going to last? Can we predict that from the shapes of these two signals?
Yes.
Because?
Finite length.
The finite length, so
we could add some of the lengths.
And then subtract 1 because there has to be one sample of overlap. So we can actually compute the extent of the output. It's dependent on the widths of the input and the impulse response. I'm actually not sure. I think this is wrong. I think this should be n greater than 5. But so we can essentially compute the duration of the output as the length of the signal plus the length of the impulse response minus 1. And that's a good sanity check when you're doing convolution. Now, there's an interesting consequence of this, which we will see later in the semester. As you convolve two waveforms, what generally can you say about the output that results from the convolution of those two waveforms? If I draw any two shapes, this is some signal, and this is some impulse response. What's going to happen to the output?
It's
going to
be longer.
It's going to be kind of stretched, right? And we'll see later in the semester that generally that means the frequency content of this signal has less high frequency than either of these two signals. This is actually a low-pass filtering operation. And this is one of the ways you begin to understand that most systems in the real world act as some form of low-pass filter, because the output from those systems is essentially smeared values of the input, and that smearing tends to stretch the signal in the time domain, which in turn typically decreases the amount of high frequency content in the signal. Okay, so we'll come back to graphical convolution, but now what I want to talk about are some mathematical consequences of this. So we've demonstrated that if h of n, well, we've talked about the fact that the impulse response is what results from a signal, an impulse function being applied to a linear time invariant system. So if the system happens to have an impulse response, which is delta of n, and I apply a signal, some arbitrary signal, x of n, to this system, which has an impulse response, delta of n, what are we going to get for an output? Well, we can go through the computations. We can write that y of n is equal to the sum from k is equal to minus infinity to plus infinity of x of k times h of n minus k. But if h of n is delta of n, then h of n minus k is delta of n minus k, and I essentially have the sum of x of k times delta of n minus k, which just gives me back x of n. So if the system has an impulse response, which is delta of n, when I apply the input, I essentially get the output. That's what we call an identity operator. Similarly, if the system, so you're thinking, okay, well, that was a waste of my time. That was kind of stupid. But this is actually not so stupid. If the system has a impulse, its impulse response is a delayed delta of n function, what am I going to get as an output?
X delayed as an output.
I'm just going to get the input delayed by n0. Now, how do we as humans tend to perceive delay, for example, with sound?
Echo.
We think of it as echo. We think of it, when you talk about binaural hearing, and you hear a sound and you localize it over there, how are you actually doing that?
A little bit longer on the right ear.
What?
It takes a little bit longer to get to it.
It arrives at your, you know, whichever, your right ear in my case, before it, earlier than it arrives in my left ear, and my brain recognizes that, measures that time delay, and localizes the sound. So, guess what wonderful technology exploits this very simple fact?
Stereo what? Sound.
Stereo, even better than stereo?
Surround sound.
This is basically the principle of surround sound. Surround sound is nothing more than delaying inputs to the left and right speakers to produce, and of course the rear speakers as well, to produce this kind of spatial sound field. And we'll see later on that this is an essentially phase delay. So time delay and phase delay are very much related. And in fact, what audio systems do is they play with the phase of the signal to produce that kind of spatial sense.
There's a good bit of amplitude modulation that has to happen for spatial recognition too, isn't there? Or is it all just delay?
No, spatial, well, sound localization, meaning the direction, and that is basically done purely on time delay information. But to simulate concert halls and things like that, all the sound effects processing, they also introduce frequency. What makes a concert hall a particular concert hall is its frequency response and its time delay properties. So, you know, when you hit the jazz club button on your stereo, they're, in addition to doing the time delay stuff, they're imposing a frequency response. Okay, so now we can also go in another direction. Instead of doing time delay, we can talk about integration. What was the relationship between the unit pulse and the unit step function? We talked
about
at the beginning of the semester, we had delta of t, and then we had u of t, and the relationship was?
Pulse is the derivative of the step.
Right, and the step is the integral of the pulse, and the ramp function was the integral of?
The step.
The step, right? So, what happens if the impulse response of our system is a unit step function? Well, when we apply a signal to that system, we can write the sum from k is equal to minus infinity to plus infinity of x of k, u of n minus k. And this operation is simply the integration or the summation of the input. So in the discrete time sense, this is a summer. We'll see later in the continuous time system, this is actually an integrator. The unit step function, if you want to build an integrator, you build a system whose impulse response is equal to the unit step function. And we do, in fact, do this quite a lot. We'll see towards the end of the course a whole set of control systems based on this principle. So we can take this one step further. We can say, well, let's let x of n be equal to u of n. X of n is a unit step. Let's let h of n be equal to some kind of exponentially decaying unit step. So this a to the n, a is just some constant, and a constant which is less than 1. So this is just going to be a signal whose amplitude decreases exponentially. So it's just going to be something that looks like this, where these amplitudes are a to the n. So if I plug that into our convolution integral, then I'm left with u of n, a to the n, u of n. And this, if you sort of work through this, I won't go through all the steps here, you can actually write this as an infinite series. And that infinite series has a summation, a closed form summation expression, which looks like this. And this is actually what's called a leaky integrator, or an integrator that forgets. And this is, again, used in practice with a lot of systems, whether we're talking about things like cruise controls or whether we're talking about motion sensors. This kind of a system is actually used quite a lot in practice. And you can control the way the system behaves by essentially just adjusting this constant. And later in the semester, we'll talk about how you can design systems using that constant. Now, the properties, the convolution has some important properties associated with it. And I'm going to introduce these properties today, but later in the semester, we'll actually prove these for continuous time convolution. And we're going to show eventually that these kinds of properties hold for all of the operators we're going to talk about this semester, whether we're talking about convolution, Laplace transforms. These properties are actually typically consequences of linear systems, and that's what we deal with in this course. But for the moment, let me just introduce these as properties of convolution. So the first thing we'll introduce is the commutative property. X of n convolved with h of n is equal to h of n convolved with x of n. In other words, whether I apply x of n to the system with h of n, or I take h of n and apply it to a system with x of n, with an impulse response of x of n, I get the same result. And you can see how that's true because the convolution sum is just the product, and the product multiplication obeys the commutative property. So this is a useful property. Most linear operators have to obey this kind of a property. One way you can use this, you can put this thing to work, this is actually, again, how you can do sound field processing. You can measure a concert hall, get its impulse response, and then you can use that impulse response to generate signals which have been, which sound like they've been recorded or collected in that kind of an environment. A second important property is the distributive property. X of n convolved with two impulse responses, h1 of n plus h2 of n, just results in x of n convolved with h1 of n plus x of n convolved with h2 of n. In other words, if I have a system which is the sum of two impulse responses, I can either compute the output by adding those impulse responses together, or I could compute the output by computing the output one of those systems, each system individually, and then summing the outputs. This is a lot like what you're used to doing with circuits when you combine resistors in series or resistors in parallel, and actually your ability to do that is a result of this kind of a property. Similarly, we have an associative property, which applies to, you can think of this as a parallel connection, you can think of this as a cascade connection. So if we have X of n convolved with H1 of n, and then in turn convolved with H2 of n, that can be computed as X of n convolved with H1 of n, and then taking the output of that and convolving it with H2 of n, or we could do that in reverse order. We can convolve X of n with H2 of n, and then convolve it, the result with H1 of n. So that says that whether we apply H1 first, or H2 first, or the product of H1 and H2, we get the same result. And this is one of the ways that we will build. This allows us to essentially simplify systems. This is sort of how MATLAB works. You figure out all the different aspects of your system, and then you combine all those into one big transfer function that describes the input-output relationship of your complicated system. And then you can write computer simulations where you apply signals and produce the outputs that those signals would produce. Now there's a few other properties that I'll touch on today, and then we will sort of come back to these throughout the semester. The first notion is this notion of causality, and this is really an important one. Last time we defined the concept of causality. A system is causal if what is true.
It depends on the way it happened. In other words, it doesn't depend on what happened before t equals zero.
The output does not depend on things in the future, right?
Right.
Good. Very good. So, if you have a signal, and you're looking at the output at time n0, you would like to be able to compute that output by only looking at things that have happened from this point in time previously. If what happens here depends on things in the future, we have a problem. Now think about the fact that with convolution, we flip h of n, right? So, if h of n looks like this, this is actually h of minus k, what's going to happen as I compute the output at a particular point in time? Essentially the center time. This piece of the function is going to reach into the future, right? And therefore, the output is going to depend on things that are happening in the future. And that will make the system non-causal. Let me go back to our... I guess I can do it from here. If you remember, let me actually go back one more. Here we have an h of n. This was the example that we worked previously. When I flip this, These points are going to appear over here, and those are going to reach into the future and make the system non-causal. So if H of n, so for a system to be causal, H of n has to be 0 for n less than 0. If it's not, the system's going to be non-causal. So for a system to be causal, H of n has to be equal to 0 for n less than 0. This is one of the consequences of the convolution operation. And that's an important consideration, and that's a very easy way to tell if a system, whether a system's causal. For a system to be stable, and stable means if you apply a bounded input, that the output is also bounded, the sum of the absolute values of the input, of the impulse response, have to be less than infinity. So that's what we call a stability condition. And we'll use that later in the semester. And here I've sort of sketched a proof of that. You can sort of look at the convolution integral and from that deduce that this is what this has to be true for the system to be stable. And this is just a mathematical way of stating that that sum is less than infinity. So stability is something that we're going to be interested in, particularly showing that a system is unconditionally stable, because if systems are not stable for all expected types of inputs, you run into problems. And later in the semester, we'll talk about a few classic examples of this, but you may be familiar with some of the famous case studies in this area. The Verrazano Bridge, we'll talk about that a little bit later in the semester. The bridge that collapsed in the 1940s because it became unstable. The space shuttle, a lot of attention is paid to stability when the space shuttle re-enters, because that's a point in time where the system is on the verge of being unstable. It's a very dangerous time, and they do a whole bunch of things to make sure that the space shuttle will re-enter smoothly, and that becomes a problem in stability. And if it doesn't, if they don't do it right, then of course it either burns up or it bounces off the Earth's atmosphere and goes back out into space. That's sort of another classic example of stability. We'll also talk about pendulums, and later in the course we'll actually show how you can take unstable systems like a pendulum and stabilize them. We'll show a nice video where people have built machines that can stabilize pendulums when they're standing vertically, and people riding bicycles and things like that. So stability and causality are two things we can determine from the impulse response, and it's just another reason why the impulse responses are so important. So what we've done today is we've introduced a method for computing the output of a discrete time, linear time invariant system, and that method is known as convolution. This is the principal way that we compute the output in the time domain. We've demonstrated how this operation can be performed both analytically and graphically. You will have some homework problems to work where you'll do the analytic solutions. You'll also then work those problems graphically with pencil and paper. But then you'll also do these in MATLAB, and you will then further show you later, I think next class, I will show you how to do this with an animated Java applet. So we got a lot of different ways that you can get the answer to a convolution problem, and therefore you should never miss a convolution problem, because there's four or five different ways you can get the answer. And the analytical solutions can get pretty messy, because when the input waveforms get complicated, doing these calculations is not too easy. So we'll rely on computers for those kinds of problems. We discussed three important properties. We'll see these properties throughout the semester with all the transforms we talk about: commutative, associative, and distributive. And we talked about how we can determine key properties of the system, such as causality and stability, by examining the impulse response. So the impulse response becomes a very important way to characterize a linear system. Later in the course, we'll see that when we take the Fourier transform, or the Fourier series of the impulse response, we essentially get the frequency response of the system. And that's why that's a nice thing, because by changing the impulse response, you can change the frequency response, and again, that's essentially how a lot of audio processing works. All you're really doing are changing the numbers you store for this filter, for this function, h of n. But your software is always just applying h of n to the input signal. And all you have to do is change the values stored in memory for that function, and you can create a wide range of audio environments. And that's a very good, I think, interesting example of DSP, that just by changing numbers of this function, you can go from outdoor concert halls to indoor, very high-performance concert halls, or reverberant rooms like this room. And that can all be done just by changing the way you describe this filter. Okay, so we'll stop there, and I think also in the recitation section, you'll go through some convolution problems. And I'll see you on Wednesday.